Like many veterans, Matt Gallagher has stories to tell, but unlike most, he's shaped them into a first novel called Youngblood.
One of the themes that I kept returning to was the legacy of armed conflict, both in this Iraqi town, exploring this ghost story of this legendary soldier gone missing in action, but also the stories we tell each other as an American culture, as an American society. These two very different narrative shadows of World War II, the Grand Just War, and Vietnam, which has left a very different mark. You know, as an Iraq War veteran, both of those wars, you know, my grandfather served in World War II, my uncle served in Vietnam. My parents protested Vietnam. So, you know, almost through osmosis, my generation grew up with these embedded in our history.
A finalist for the 2016 Dayton Literary Peace Prize, Matt Gallagher reads from Youngblood, the fictional book praised by veterans, senators, and acclaimed writers such as Richard Ford and the master of Vietnam War stories, Tim O'Brien. This is New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Matt Gallagher joined ROTC, the Army's Reserve Officers Training Corps, at age 18, just 1 week before 9/11. And then, after graduating from North Carolina's Wake Forest University, he served in the Army from 2005 through 2009. In the midst of the Iraq War, then-Captain Gallagher wrote a blog called Kaboom, detailing everyday life as an active duty soldier. Ordered to stop it in 2008, the blog later morphed into his first book, A Memoir by the Same Name, and inspired ensuing essays as well as his second book, the 2016 novel, Youngblood. Gallagher was interviewed at the Kansas City Public Library as part of the 2017 Writers at Work series by a fellow novelist who was embedded as a writer in Iraq. He's also authored a war novel based on stories he collected there called The Good Lieutenant. Here's UMKC's Whitney Terrell to begin the conversation about Matt Gallagher's novel, Youngblood.
For an American war novel, this book has an extraordinary number of very complicated and well-drawn Iraqi characters. Was that a deliberate choice? Look, I'm going to make Iraqis an important part of this novel.
It was important to me personally, and it was important to me as an artist. So often, and I don't think this is limited to contemporary war, American war literature and how we relate as a culture and society to war, is it's something that is happening elsewhere, and we send our young people in uniform to go do. And if they're lucky, they come back mostly intact. But it's always something happening someplace else. It's an event. It might as well be a different space dimension. And, you know, my experience as a young person, I'd expected that going in as a scout platoon leader. That was the kind of war we'd trained for. And I found myself relying on that training sometimes, but more often than not, getting to know everyday Iraqis in a way that I'd never anticipated. And I found myself asking my mom to send me Iraqi history books and Iraqi culture books so I could maybe learn a little bit more and then hopefully teach my platoon a bit more. Our goal over there in 2007 and 2008 was trying to separate the insurgents for the populace.
Right.
But how could you do that if you don't understand the populace?
And then how did you figure out how to write about them?
I was there in late 2007 and 2008 as part of the surge. And setting the novel in 2011, a few years after I was there, close to the withdrawal, as America was declaring victory and some semblance of stability had returned to the country, allowed me a way to look back on the war as a whole, capture some breadth and totality of the nine-year war and occupation that had taken place. I'd been there for 15 months, which certainly felt like a long time in the midst of it, but really that was just kind of a drop in the bucket compared to those 9 years of war and occupation that nobody endured more than the Iraqi people. So I wanted to kind of capture that. Even before I dreamed of writing a novel about this, that was important to me. So when I sat down to write, before I made any kind of the big decisions about when or where, what kind of themes I wanted to convey, I did want to do my best with full dimensional Iraqi characters, make them more than victims, make them more than caricatures. Some of them are heroes in the book, some of them are villains.
Yeah.
And most of them are both, because that's real life. And the same dimensionality I sought to give to my American soldier characters, I wanted to give to my Iraqi characters as well.
Maybe if you could just sort of outline for the audience where the novel is set, give them a sense of the landscape and like timing in terms of the arc of the war in Iraq.
Most of the novel is set in a sectarian town. It's a fictional town named Asharia, but the region it's set in is very real in the farmlands northwest of Baghdad, kind of right where that sectarian fault line between the Shia spillover from the urban areas around Baghdad start to fade out and the Sunni tribes from out west in Anbar are spilling out. So it's kind of a meeting of two different very visions of Iraq happening in this town and community. And unsurprisingly, that fault line was really kind of where the Iraqi army, when ISIS made their big push a couple years ago, that's where the Iraqi army dug in and held them there, you know, for geographical reasons as well as cultural and societal ones. That area of Iraq continues to be vital and serve as a microcosm maybe to what's going on in the country as a whole.
Was that the same place you were deployed?
Similar-ish. I bounced around a little bit. I was on both sides of the Tigris, but the first part of my tour, when I was still a lieutenant and still a platoon leader, was in that area.
You have a camp. It's Camp Independence in the novel. I'm assuming that's like Camp Liberty?
It was kind of a fusion of Liberty, Victory, and Taji.
Camp Liberty is a very big military installation that's connected to the Baghdad International Airport and had about 40,000 people on it when I was there.
So. Yeah, and those big bases, we called them Little America, somewhat ironically and somewhat not. I mean, you had Pizza Huts, you had Taco Bells. The entire might of the military-industrial complex was on display. And in some ways, that was incredibly impressive. But then you drive 5 miles away from base, and there wasn't clean water, there wasn't stable electricity. And many of the local Iraqis, very understandably so, could not understand the phrase was, how can you land a man on the moon, but you've been here for 7 years and can't bring stable electricity? And for a 23-year-old English major who very earnestly wanted to bring that electricity, I didn't have great answers for them, but I wanted to work to help achieve that. And at least when I was there, it seemed like some progress was being made. Unfortunately, that turned out to be all too temporary.
I embedded with some of the guys who were in charge of making electricity for Camp Balad, and this was in 2010, so closer to where your book is set. Mm-hmm. A lot of the problem, according to them, was that doing infrastructure projects when you're also being attacked is difficult. It wasn't really until around 2010 or 2011 that the country was pacified enough for us to do the kind of infrastructure projects that we were good at.
Right, yeah. Security and stability has to come before anything else in counterinsurgency doctrine. And then throw on top of that the litany of politics, both national Shia Sunni and then the local tribal politics of who gets this contract and who gets that contract. It was just a labyrinth to try to navigate.
Right. The main character, Jack Porter, is in a smaller outpost. Like how many people would probably have been?
40 to 50.
Yeah. And so they're in charge of that area of countryside that's around their smaller base.
Correct. Yeah. And Jack of all trades, masters of none, you know, there to conduct security operations, work with the local Iraqi police and local Iraqi army, but also go door to door and ask Iraqi grandmothers how many hours a day they're getting electricity missions and often having the door slammed on them, which is a humbling experience. I can speak from personal experience
on
that.
There is a scene in which Jack is doing that.
You're listening to veteran Matt Gallagher here on New Letters on the Air as he discusses his Iraqi war novel, Youngblood, with fellow novelist Whitney Terrell.
I thought maybe you could outline the major characters.
The story is narrated by a young lieutenant named Jack Porter, who's a younger brother of a war hero. His brother earned a Silver Star in Iraq in 2005 during the quote-unquote more kinetic parts of the war, when it was a lot more kind of force-on-force violence. Jack feels like the war has passed him by. You know, he's not really quite sure what he's doing there. He's kind of boyishly earnest, I'd say, and trying to do right by his men as they're withdrawing from this country. And he's slowly seeing more and more evidence that leaving at this time maybe isn't the best thing for these people and for its future. During this process, a experienced sergeant named Daniel Chambers is assigned to this unit. He's on his fourth tour. He's been deployed to Iraq 3 times and Afghanistan once. Chambers is a survivor. And all that matters to him is bringing those junior soldiers home in one piece. And if I were a parent or a spouse of one of those young soldiers, you know, what more would you want out of your experienced platoon sergeant than to hear, "Don't worry, ma'am, I'll bring your kid home." On the other hand, there's going to be some moral and ethical dilemmas and confrontations when that mission bumps into the broader mission of protecting this Iraqi community and protecting these Iraqi people and trying to bring some semblance of peace and stability to it.
Right. I mean, no novel can work without there being an ethical conflict. And the novel seems like it's centered around what Jack believes is his role and what Chambers believes is his role and their tactics for achieving what their goals are.
Yeah. And I think in a way, they probably want the same things most of the time. They just have very divergent methods of accomplishing that. And I hope the reader has a clear moral understanding of right and wrong in that situation. But something I wanted to do with the novel was make it murky and make it complicated and try to remind readers maybe unfamiliar with this world how quickly entire lives can be changed in a matter of seconds. And what do you do when there are no good options, when your entire purpose of being, your entire role is to try to figure out the least bad of all awful options? And that's something that Jack and Chambers find themselves dealing with repeatedly, I think.
So there's also a mystery plot in the book. There's a missing soldier named Elijah Rios, who is sort of legendary, who died in this area. And it ends up being sort of Jack's role to figure out what happened with his murder, how he got killed, and unravel the story of that previous deployment, but also the story of this whole entire town and the people who live in it, right?
Yeah, Rios was kind of a way for me to play with mythology, right? We're all storytelling creatures, and the military especially kind of subsists off of storytelling, particularly oral storytelling. I think there's a reason most veterans are incredible storytellers. Rios had been in this town 5 years before Jack, and Jack starts to learn of him through local Iraqis. This legendary soldier somehow walked these same streets, these same alleyways, dealt with the same Iraqi sheiks, yet had an entirely different experience in Iraq than Jack did. So Jack originally becomes kind of fascinated with him and is trying to track down the truce that gave birth to this myth. Chambers served.
Oh, yeah, they make a truce between the Shia and the Sunni.
Yeah.
And that's what Rios creates.
The Sons of Iraq, the Sawa, which was okay. a very real thing.
Right.
In the novelization, Rios was instrumental in bringing that to be. And if you're not familiar with what happened, then that happened in late 2006, 2007, and played a big role in kind of the temporary decline in violence in the country, you know, essentially kind of created an armed neighborhood watch.
But that was also paid
armed neighborhood watch in these Iraqi communities. And sometimes these were made up of former Al-Qaeda fighters. And a lot of soldiers, Chambers is one of them, had a lot of moral and ethical struggles with that, and understandably so. In some cases, these Sawa had American blood on their hands. On the other hand, what other options?
It was like paying your enemies to be your friend.
Yeah.
For a certain amount of time. I think that gives people a good background in the novel. I wanted you to read a part that actually relates to what we're just talking about and how negotiations would go between the U.S. Army and the local Iraqis in this area. And then Snoop, who's Sudanese, but who's an interpreter.
Sure.
We'll listen to some of the novel, Youngblood. It's the end of the Iraqi War in 2011, and the main character, Lieutenant Jack Porter, is waiting in the countryside with his platoon to pay off some local civilians who are late in arriving from their cousin's funeral. Here's the writer and Iraqi War veteran, Matt Gallagher.
Peace has been achieved and victory has been declared, but there are signs that neither of those things will be lasting. There's been an accidental shooting at a traffic point. American soldiers shooting a pair of Iraqi civilians. And this is the aftermath. For the soldiers, this is the first moment of disruption. Obviously, for the local Iraqis in year nine, they're well used to tragedies such as this. Another 40 minutes passed in slow drips of sun. We killed time with great precision, skipping rocks and telling stories of home. Stories of girls, stories of late nights and foggy mornings. Stories exaggerated and stories seared into outright lies. The desert heat bleached everything, including the minds and memories of its occupiers. "You got any good stories, sir?" Hogg asked. I stroked my bare chin and considered. Part of me wanted to participate, but the officer in me demanded I tread carefully. "I didn't party much in high school," I said, "but in college, I went to class in a SpongeBob bathrobe for a semester." I patted my slung rifle for effect. The soldiers laughed. The younger guys liked hearing stories about college. It gave them something to look forward to after this, even the ones who knew they would never use their GI Bill funds. The sound of a car motor droned through the still, coming closer and echoing off the blast walls. My chest seized up, and my muscles went taut. I wasn't the only one. Like figures in a diorama, we took our places, poised and alert. We were what we pretended it to be. As the ranking enlisted man, Dominguez took the lead, walking through a maze of razor wire set across the dirt to impede car bombs. Hogg followed, moving with more self-consciousness, but less care. Alphabet rotated his turret from side to side like a swivel to remind the approaching car he was up there, and so too was the machine gun. I assumed my place behind the last strand of wire, shoulders cocked, back straight, head rigid, visualizing how the imperial officers of the past had stood when they bought peace for their country in strange lands far from home. The car pulled up to the checkpoint, its driver idling the engine. Dominguez instructed both the driver and the passenger to get out. It was a blue sedan, similar in make to the one shot up by 1st Platoon. The Iraqi brothers stood to the side, where Hogg patted them down and then searched in and under the car. After the driver opened the trunk, Dominguez shouted a strident, "All clear!" The soldiers and Iraqis began walking around the wire strands, and I went to the back of the Humvee for a black canvas backpack filled with stacks of $100 American bills, 2,500 in total. We called it condolence funds. They called it fossil. Blood money seemed most apt, though the commander had freaked when I'd called it that the previous night. "That's cynical," he'd said. "We can't afford to be cynical right now." I'd wanted to argue that the Army's distortion of language was far more cynical. Military-aged male, for example, militarized any Iraqi with a dick between the ages 12 and 60, whether a harmless shepherd or a zombie Zarqawi, but one look at the commander had suggested he wasn't interested in philosophical debate. So I just said, "Yes, sir," and left it alone. We converged in front of the Humvee. I'd expected the brothers to arrive in traditional man dresses because of the funeral, but both wore the uniform of the urban young man on the prowl, tight dress shirts open at the collar, pressed slacks, narrow pointed leather shoes that shined like sunspots. Both wore long tidy mustaches and smelled of ginger. The one I presumed to be older had rolled up his sleeves to display a heavy gold watch, while the younger one kept thumbing prayer beads in the palm of his hand. "Salaam alaikum," I said, raising my right hand to my heart and cupping it. The older Iraqi stared at me with hard, angry eyes, two black stones rolling across a flat berm of a face. Snoop chewed his lip while Dominguez waved the soldiers back to their positions at the gate. I looked past the brothers and up at the sun and reminded myself that I was the one with the gun. It was the younger Iraqi who ended the standoff. "Salaam," he said, curtly. I turned to him and spoke. "Snoop, tell these guys the money is all here. They can count it out on the hood of the Humvee. One will need to sign a contract stating receipt. They can't keep the backpack, though. Battalion needs it." Snoop nodded again, pursing his lips and tapping his foot in the manner of a professional athlete, feigning deference to a referee. I waited out their conversation, watching a large roach the color of sand shimmy across the ground. Then I remembered that Iraq didn't have roaches, and even if it did, they didn't have two claws and a raised trident for a tail. I took a step back while Snoop tried to smash the scorpion with his boot. It escaped under the tire of the Humvee. "F***," Snoop said. "A shaitan." I shivered in the heat. Getting blown into gut soup by a roadside bomb, I'd reconciled myself to the possibility. An unseen sniper's bullet eating my little eternity like a goat eats a can, I'd never know the difference. But the chance of a silent assassin in hard-shelled bug form lying in wait under my pillow or in one of my boots had proven a recurring panic. The things didn't even bleed. I looked back up at the Iraqis. The older brother was glowering, all flat-topped aggression, while the younger brother fiddled with a dead tooth in his mouth, eyes still hunting for the scorpion. Then the older one grabbed the contract from Snoop and signed it on his brother's back. While he did this, I noticed his signing hand had the pinky nail grown out. It gleamed in the light. He shoved the sheet of paper at me and barked at Snoop. "He say, 'Well, I won't tell you,' Snoop said, 'but their cousin was no Ali Baba. He worked the date groves by the canal.' 'And the part you didn't translate?' I asked." Snoop sighed. "To the eyes of hell." An Iraqi slur. I nodded and stuck my hands in my pockets. My feet ached. So did my right collarbone, that old bane of an intramural wound. An exoskeleton of sweat had formed under my body armor and uniform. No amount of water would end the drought in my throat. My men had already been out here for too many hours and wouldn't be relieved until this was over. In theory, I wanted to empathize with these men who'd lost a loved one to an ignorant, violent occupation they called the collapse. In theory, I found the exchange of blood money, by any name, in any culture, to be abhorrent. In theory, my memories of their dead cousin's sundered intestines and his wailing mother meant something more than just still-shot photographs soaked in gore. In theory, in an air-conditioned classroom I'd once sat in with great clarity and wrath, I would grasp and grapple for a solution that bridged this vast divide. Because it was the right thing to do. Because right things to do were worth grasping and grappling for, and not just in air-conditioned classrooms. In practice, though, things were different. They just were. Inshallah, I said, back straight, shoulders cocked. As God wills it. I folded up the contract and stuck it into a cargo pocket. Then I walked to the outpost, leaving any regrets at the gate. Discarded waste for strangers to take away in the dead of night.
Thank you.
Matt Gallagher, reading at the Kansas City Public Library from his debut novel, Youngblood, a finalist for the 2016 Dayton Literary Peace Prize. Gallagher got his MFA in creative writing at Columbia University in 2013 after his service in Iraq. Again, here's the director of the Writers at Work series, Whitney Terrell.
Did you have sources that you went to, or how did you think about creating these different characters?
I certainly relied on some of my own memories and experiences,
yeah.
But it had been enough time that I didn't really trust them all that much anymore. You know, memory does this to us all, right? It distorts and warps. Usually the bad stuff kind of gets filtered out. It's what we all do just to keep on going. So I read a lot more journalism and nonfiction works about Iraq, both from my Iraq and going back in time, than is probably healthy for somebody recently back from that country. You know, I kept a blog overseas. So it was an interesting time capsule for me to kind of, as I was writing this, I'd go back to it sometimes for sensory details, usually, to remember exactly how it felt to be wearing 70 pounds of body armor in 120-degree heat, not how an MFA student remembered it. And usually that meant going back and crossing out my very illustrious simile that I'd spent way too much time on.
And you guys had interpreters, right?
We did, and I stayed in touch with them and sent them questions and everything.
Were they in the same situation as Snoop, where Snoop, the main interpreter, his name is Kazim, mm-hmm. he spends the novel trying to get a visa to the United States and asks Porter to write a letter for him? Was that happening with the interpreters that you dealt with?
Some of them. My personal interpreter was a middle-aged man who was quite content staying in the Little Sudan neighborhood of Baghdad.
So he was Sudanese.
He
also
was Sudanese.
Oh,
so I did borrow that because I thought it was an interesting kind of go between. You know, interpreters in many ways are people stuck between two worlds and yet have to be kind of masters of both and trying to bridge this vast divide. So in addition to having worked with Sudanese interpreters myself, it seemed like an apt choice in this story, having a main character who is really kind of Jack's only confidant for most of it. You know, Jack feels kind of stuck between two worlds. The America that he grew up in and remembers and is still pretty fresh from, and this combat zone, and having his confidant trapped between two worlds of his own felt right.
I also wanted to bring this up because I know we've all been following the military's reaction to President Trump's decision to ban immigration from seven countries, also including Iraq. Most of the military people that I know are very upset about this because their interpreters or people that they worked with are still trying to get back into the country and can't come or will never be able to come. I wondered if you could speak to that.
It's a disgrace. It's a betrayal. These men and women have given more to America, frankly, than many Americans will ever dream of. And for us to be so negligent with their lives is just a disgrace. And, you know, not to get too political, because I know we're here to talk literature, but I feel the same
literature
way about refugees.
Literature and politics are the same thing.
That's true.
One of the reasons that literature is political is that it forces you to empathize with the characters that you're reading about, which is why it's important for there to be three-dimensional Iraqi characters in a war novel. I would recommend Matt's novel for that reason.
I say this from personal experience, and then the statistics back this up. 99% of the people living in these countries want the same things we do. Want peace and tranquility. They're fleeing the very people that we have professed to combat.
Yeah.
And it's just a disgrace and negligence beyond belief.
Yes, I agree.
Thank you.
So I wanted to just mention a couple of things that I found also very amusing and interesting were some of the cultural references. I don't think people realize the amount of Western culture that is part of Iraq. Raina, important female character in the novel, talks about minimalist decor and watching Real Housewives of Cairo. Mm-hmm. She's interested in Taibo. There's all this sort of detail that I think becomes muted by the flattened way of thinking about Iraqis or any other foreign person through American media. Literature can change that, hopefully.
I think so. I mean, I've been back, 8 years now. And, you know, you watch the news of Syria or Afghanistan, and it's so easy to kind of view these places as just bomb-cratered deserts, and there's nothing else. But these are communities. These
Iraqis
are neighborhoods.
Are really funny. They have a really good sense of humor.
Yeah, and it's a fatalistic sense of humor that appeals to my Irish side. Much like the Irish, you know, you've been through a lot of different empires and a lot of different tragedies. Sometimes all you can do is laugh, and you develop a really wicked sense of humor. One thing I did want to convey was something that is different in Iraq. There's almost no middle class. And so the disparity between the local tribal brokers and the sheikhs that often, even as a junior military officer, we were dealing with, and I'm sure you encountered a whole bunch yourself, those are the people you had to go through to make the decisions. You know, then you drive 5 minutes away into the neighborhood that they were technically in charge of, and it was a poverty unlike anything in the States.
Kind of like a warlord, Fat Mukhtar, right? He's skimming money from the United States. There's a scene in which he points at all the things around him and says, mine, mine. I mean, is this kind of the attitude that you're talking about?
Yeah, and I think that's such a jarring thing for any American soldier. I remember talking to a colonel who was on his third deployment, and he's like, I still can't get used to it. But right or wrong, that was the decision the American military made around 2007 and 2008 in the pursuit of something resembling stability. These are the power brokers we're going to have to go through. And the corruption was rampant because these were the men who were getting the contracts. And how much of that money was flowing down to the people that needed it the most? Very little.
Jack is an idealist, or at least it seems to me. Maybe you can disagree with, you know, you wrote him, but I get to then.
Sure,
since I'm the reader, I get to make my own ideas up.
That's how it works.
But he does say at one point, to know idealism as something more than a word, that's what I wanted. And then he also mentions at a certain point in the novel when some things are not going well, he says, our grandfathers had pushed back the onslaught of fascism. Just what the fuck were we doing? And I wondered if you had been an idealist going into the army, if that was anything that came out of you, or you're creating a character that's different than yourself.
I love Jack. I find him so endearing.
Right.
But from that blog, I realized I was angry. I was not sleeping a lot. And I don't think I'm an angry person usually.
Right.
So that was interesting. So
you were
that
also
way,
in the war at a different time.
A bit different. First 4 months were more kinetic than anything Jack and his platoon deals with.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, not compared
to.
So
what were you angry about?
Everything. The military bureaucracy, the fact that we couldn't get electricity running as quickly as I thought we needed to.
You were a more skeptical person.
I was much more skeptical than Jack, even when we got there. Are there pieces of me in Jack? Certainly. But I wanted to put pieces of me in every character.
Right.
You know, Rana. You know, I've never been an Iraqi mother of two, obviously. But I have known loss. I have wondered what if. I have been woken up in the dead of night wanting more from God and then feeling awful for doing that, thinking about other people who are much worse off than me. So, you know, I wanted to put those parts of me in Rana. And I think it's any writer's duty to breathe life into their characters accordingly. I think it's natural that I get the Are You Jack question, maybe similar biographies, and it's a first-person novel.
Hey, first-person narrators have to be characters and should be different than the author. It's just that the audience is often misunderstood.
Sure,
that.
Sure.
Were you opposed to the war in Iraq when
I was.
It happened?
I was an ROTC cadet, and I had deep misgivings about it. But I was also 20 and knew that I didn't know a lot and wanted to be part of something bigger than myself and wanted to participate in history in some small way. Hopefully for the better. I think it's amazing. Part of this racket that I do now is you talk to current ROTC cadets who have grown up their entire lives. America's been at war. It's normal for them to have been at war. And yet we're still producing people like that, that want to serve our country, which is amazing. And we as a society need to prove worthy of that drive.
Could we all give Matt a round of applause?
Thank you.
Matt Gallagher at the Kansas City Public Library, interviewed by Whitney Terrell about his debut novel, Youngblood. Since 2013, the Iraqi war veteran has served as an instructor for Words After War, a weekly writing workshop that brings veterans and civilians together to examine war through literature. For links, visit newletters.org. Produced by New Letters Magazine at UMKC, today's show was produced with Emma Fernhout, Jordan Hooper, Claire Verbeck, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.